All right, from Studio Live in Cumberland, BC, you're listening to the Edible Valley Podcast. I'm Chef Jonathan Fraser.
And I'm your co-host, Darren Howlett. Thanks for joining us as we explore the Comox Valley food culture and beyond. Tonight we're talking charcuterie, right, John?
That's right, we're down with charcuterie. So Should be a little interesting to sort of talk about what is charcuterie and what is this all about? And
it hasn't, I found... You know, if you go up and down the island or to the Vancouver, it's on all menus, maybe even starting to move away from it a bit. Hasn't really blossomed here on a lot of menus. So I have like lots of questions of defining it. I know what it is to see it, but I don't know really what makes it.
Well, I always make the joke that it's just a French, fancy French term for cold cuts.
Yeah.
But that's not it at all, right?
Right.
We're talking about curing meats. So we're talking about hams as well as sausages, you know, pate, confit, all those styles of ways of preserving meats.
Right.
So this is what we want to get into. And so we brought a couple guests in with us today.
Yeah. So let's talk about curing and preserving meats. So who do we have with us today? We have Brian McCormick of Clever Crow. Hi, Brian.
Yes. Hello.
Welcome back.
Welcome back.
Thanks.
This is episode four. Your fourth episode on for us?
It may be. Three for sure.
Right? And we have Cohen Brown. Cohen, I know that you have... I know it's Salumai, but I can't remember the name of your company.
Sure, yeah. The name of my company, or my soon-to-be company, is actually Clandestino. Which refers to a salumi project, and I'll distinguish that for you guys in a bit from charcuterie.
Sure.
Because I'm actually... That's my specialty.
Right. Perfect. Okay, so I guess where do we go from here? Let's talk about, I guess, where you both come at it from. You're saying, why don't we expand on that?
Sure, yeah, I think that's probably a good place to jump in because you're talking about charcuterie, and that's very much a French discipline, or that's the French word for it anyway,
right.
for cured meats, pâtés, confits, as you suggest. And my background and training is in Italian cured meats, which
right.
is the Italian for which the Italian word for charcuterie then is salumi,
right.
Coming from sale, salt, to preserve things in salt.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
And so there's a whole range of products. There's overlap there for sure.
Right.
But the Italian stuff, especially the Southern Italian stuff, is going to be more dry cured stuff. I guess the things that people would most be aware of are things like prosciutto and salame, these kinds of things.
Right.
Yeah.
Perfect. And so these are things that you do.
These are things that I do that I've studied and I do right now as a hobby and a passion. And I experiment where I can.
Right.
I work at the butcher's block in town. I get a bit of leeway there. But we tend to do stuff more in line with this charcuterie notion of cooked meats, preserved meats, but preserved a little bit differently, not
right.
Not the dry cured stuff and also fermented things, which is what would be more just more of a version of salumi.
Right. So I guess that right there bears some distinction to what people are commonly familiar with or what they've coming to learn the term of charcuterie. They equate that to being a plate with various sliced preserved meats, maybe a little galantine, or maybe some cheeses, maybe some whatever, dried fruits, what have you. And that isn't, even though that's being presented as charcuterie, charcuterie is really the discipline of the meat preservation.
Yes, absolutely.
Right.
But I think that's just the French
right.
word for it, and that plate is dominant because it's what we see on menus.
Right.
And it's a delicious thing to have.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Wow.
My mouth is watering right now.
Sure.
And then Brian, you were John's neighbor. John's told me stories of how you had prosciutto going on in the back in the shed.
Yeah, hanging in the garage.
Yeah.
It was just sort of a backyard amateur charcuterie.
Right. Yeah.
I just sort of wanted to get sort of a side of pork, and I wanted to make my own ham and bacon, and
right.
just wanted to try to make some sausages and salami, and I got some books on it and sort of read up on it. I am a chef, but in your chef training, it sort of ends at sort of pâtés and
right.
Confit and that kind of stuff, and you sort of read in the book about different salami and stuff like that.
But that's
and
as far as you get, right?
That's as far as you get.
Yeah, this is meat. This is how you cut it. Someone else will teach you how to cure it. So
yeah. And I didn't have like a curing room or like a fridge all set up for it. So I'm doing it in the fall and the winter and trying to find the right temperature and humidity. And the garage was one place that just kind of worked out to start the process.
Sure. Well, many good hams have been made in garages, I'm sure.
Really? That's funny. My brother has, my brother's a big, I don't know, I guess I would call him a foodie, but he's very comfortable with food and very knowledgeable about food. And he tried his hand. They have one end of the house that doesn't get enough heat. And rather than be frustrated by it, he decided to try to take advantage of it. So last year he tried his hand, being that it's many more degrees colder in there. And it didn't work out. It didn't work out miserably.
Really? Okay. Well, there is that. I mean, it is. Yeah. It's a little bit tricky. It's not entirely straightforward. Although at the end of the day, I mean, the ingredients for a good prosciutto ham are three.
Right.
Pork, salt, and thyme.
Yeah.
And it's your ability to sort of manipulate those three elements that create something great. I think still a lot of places. So I spent some time in Italy, doing my training there, and a lot of the artisanal producers still do use not a garage, but a cantina or something.
Right.
So an underground kind of bunker area that isn't necessarily temperature controlled.
Oh, really?
To produce really, really great results.
Oh, wow.
You can do it. You should try again.
I had the ambition last year. I think John and I remember calling him up in a panic because I had this ham. I had bought this, I don't even know what, a ham? I mean, that was more than a ham. What would you call that?
Oh, I forgot like what it was. It was like porter.
I got it for an incredible deal, but that's because it had to be processed pretty much right away. Mm-hmm. And so as we got into it, I was like, I had it in my head that I was going to try my hand at doing a prosciutto out of it. I didn't really have the fridge space, but we had lots of fridges, and I was like, there's got to be one that I can adjust and get it right. And I had the books, and I was like, hey, I'm just going off the, flying off the cuff here. And when we opened it up, John's just like, no, you need to process this now. And that was why I'd gotten it for such a great deal.
Sure.
But we turned it out. It ended up becoming my first trial at sausages. And they're fantastic. We are still eating them. I made so many sausages, and I have a freezer full, and they're great. But yeah, that was my attempt at prosciutto. It went sideways fast.
Sounds like some of your experimenting. Hey,
yeah,
Brian?
Yeah. Well, I can remember sort of my first duck prosciutto that I had, that I got this white mold started growing all over, and I was like horrified at first, but it was one of the best mistakes that has ever happened. It was sort of the nicest tasting prosciuttos that we ever had. Like, the white mold is just wonderful. It looked like a beautiful old salami, like all covered in white, but it just completely changed.
Sure. I think, that kind of mold, that kind of penicillin mold is super desirable. And in a lot of instances here, you would inoculate with that.
Right.
So that you get a dominant microflora, positive microflora, that's going to fight off all the negative, other negative bacteria and yeast that can grow in that location. So if you can get it naturally, or you can sort of stumble into it, that's a really happy coincidence.
I was going to say, that must be really the basics behind it, right? Because you're talking about aging meat, and how is that not going rancid because you're introducing this positive?
Yeah, that's exactly it. You're either, particularly with sausages and salamis, you're trying to inoculate it with positive microflora so that it does this nice thing for you. You're actually fermenting those things too. So a salami is a fermented meat product, as frightening as that sounds. It actually is, because it gives it the proper environmental characteristics for these microflora to take hold and to produce something that's not just stable and preserved properly, but that's actually delicious, giving us all those kind of cheese flavors and those really interesting dynamic porky aromas as well.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. So here we do a lot of inoculation. So we have, in the way that you would make beer, you can buy yeasts and cultures and stuff that do that thing precisely for you. And that's kind of standard in the Canadian Health Authority. In other parts of the world, they don't necessarily do that. They're relying on the environment, like the naturally occurring environment, for those things to happen.
Right. And you bring up a good point. And, in sort of envisioning how this episode would go, I thought, it would be great if we could get into the Canadian Health Authority, or even just VIHA, Vancouver Island Health Authority. And I think that that's another episode or a series of episodes at some other time. And I don't mean to slag them. I just mean, they put out great They do put out great guidelines, and they enforce them, and they're necessary, but they also do sort of get in the way of some great things happening.
Yeah.
Maybe we can touch on that on some other, maybe. I don't know. I don't want to go too much into it because I know that we could all sit here and talk about it all night.
I'm sure. I do think that's a good idea, though. I think that a discussion, maybe even with them, to some degree would be really good to have that kind of representation. My experience thus far has been, if you approach them, they're happy to give you their guidelines. If you work with those guidelines and work with those people,
right,
you're okay. And in a lot of cases, you find yourself sort of educating one another about what it is you're doing, which is probably the experience you would have all had in kitchens to some degree or another. Yeah.
They scare me.
Yeah.
They can, sure, of course.
No, I'm used to it. But yes, definitely. It's working with them. And once you talk it out and say, communicate, their concerns, which are valid concerns, and they make you think about things. And it's a good, dynamic, but they're always the ones you don't want to see.
And that's just it. That's what I mean. In this kind of an instance, this is one of those ones where, John and I had a pasta shop. They just want to make sure everything's clean and everything's at the right temperature. Whereas I can imagine the amount of intervention when it comes to aging, fermenting, curing meat is going to be a little more hands-on.
Yeah, it definitely is. It definitely is, especially because you have big producers and you have big scares. You have, listeria outbreaks, stuff like that in big places. And so people are rightfully concerned about those kind of things.
Right.
The distinction with someone like me, I'm producing on a super small scale, built into the way in which I want to produce is a complete notion of transparency. So I'm working with animals from known farms, known breed types, really particular standards around husbandry, welfare, this kind of stuff. So
you're producing in factory or in facilities that are well reputed.
So everything is going, like the chain is all there. It's going through, you're going through, Gunter's, you're producing in a clinical space, all that stuff is happening. But I think when you're small scale and you're paying attention to all the factors and the provenance of your ingredient, and then you're doing your best to represent what that is, it's just a lot easier to stay in control of what's happening there.
Right.
And beyond that, the procedures for making this stuff, we're talking about, cultures that need to do, they need to do great things. They need to take hold. They have certain factors that need to exist. So they need cold temperatures, they need certain pH levels. So you're just built into the way in which you're making these things, your standards are really high for how you're recording that information.
Right. Wow. And so you came at this with a lot of education and you came to the Valley.
Yeah. Yes, I suppose so. At this point, for sure, it's been a varied kind of process for me. I spent some time in kitchens. I was at university for a bunch of years. Finished that at the height of the recession. There wasn't a lot of job opportunity. Wanted to go back into food. Started working at a butcher in North Vancouver. Did that for a couple years and took an opportunity to go to Italy. And I wound up going for 4 years and studied. Wow. I went for 3 months. I stayed for 4 years. I met my future wife. All of this happened. But I had this amazing opportunity to study with some maestros there who were producing phenomenal things. And because it was in Italian and I wasn't an Italian speaker, I had to sort of fumble through learning the technical stuff myself, reading books at the same time as I was in that experience, like touching, feeling, smelling things, which is why I think you can do good things in garages too, because ultimately it's the experience of navigating those things yourself and relying on, your senses.
Right.
That's going to facilitate that project. You need to obviously to accompany that with a bunch of information, but that's learnable.
Right.
What's less learnable is like finding an experience where you can chart an already accomplished system.
Right. Right. And so, okay. So if you did most of your learning by book, I guess that would put almost, same sort of education that Brian came from, in that you were probably just book learning. You had all the basics down. You had all the,
A lot of the book learning and stuff. Now, when I look back at some of the first things I tried, I didn't quite fully know sort of all the procedures, the pH and the exact temperatures and humidities that everything should have been kept. That a lot of stuff I probably just kept too cold in a fridge just for...
Right.
It just seems so odd to have essentially a raw piece of meat hanging out there. I understood it's doing things in a different way, but you almost get scared of it a little bit. So.
Right. Well, and I know, and not discrediting the fact that you're, a very accomplished chef, being that you were coming at this from an amateur angle, What have you had, like, what are your successes? What do you, like, have you had, aside from the duck prosciutto, have you had other ones that have you've been really happy with results?
Or? Oh, I've been happy pretty much with all the results. There's some stuff that some of the hams I didn't get around to having a whole leg of prosciutto in your fridge. Sometimes it's like, oh, that's kind of been there a little while now. Maybe we just shouldn't eat that anymore. But it's kind of decadent to have like a whole Parma ham sitting in your fridge.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You can only have so many friends.
Right.
Cool. So for someone who would be interested in this and wanted to get involved in this, what would you suggest they go? Like, where should they go to learn and go on with this?
And just to interject, I'm definitely one of those. I mean, I think I've mentioned it on like 8 or 9 episodes. So this is my next step, is I want to learn this.
Sure. Are we talking about dry curing stuff here? Are we talking about just, you know, charcuterie more in general? I mean, you guys are chefs, so you make coffees and these kinds of things already.
I'm just like, as an entry level to get into the whole process of processing meats, you know, in preserving meats, I guess. What is the, like, I'm not saying what's necessarily easiest, but what gives you the best foundation or groundwork?
Yeah, something for someone who wants to start out in this.
Well, there's a handful of books that are totally available. In fact, so available you can get them at the library here.
Right.
So that's a starting place, and I could suggest some of those. Yeah. Beyond that, actually, what I think is been very helpful for me, and maybe for you, Brian, I'm not sure, is that there are a few really good online communities of hobbyists. But the thing about hobbyists is that they tend to be like, they're super anal about what they're doing. And so they're charting and monitoring these things. And so there's kind of like this open source world of people doing charcuterie stuff and putting up images and showing faults and successes and asking for questions. And dotted in that community are a handful of professionals.
Oh, yeah.
And so they are you know, they're not regulating discussion, but they're certainly interjecting. And you can get information back really quickly about a certain kind of result. And I guess it's safe in the sense that you have somebody that it's going to tell you if you're wrong, and they're happy to tell you if that's not going to be good for you and you shouldn't consume that thing. But it's really good. And everything right down to how to build a curing chamber, how to do these kinds of things yourself, because it's not something you want to walk into. I've been downplaying it a little bit, saying, you know, anyone can do this. You do want to have a certain amount of knowledge behind you, what you're doing, and you want to take, you know, precautions, and there are very serious ones that you can do that. And that kind of support community coupled with a handful of books would probably get you started.
Yeah.
Will get you started.
John was actually over today and we were looking at what I had for charcuterie books, and I have one or two. Again, not necessarily focused on the end result, which a lot of people seem to interpret charcuterie as, more focused on actual, just the sort of touching in on all the basic methods and all the different various, like, all the different, like, the roulades and whatever that we were talking about, galantines, pâtés. But I found a site, I think I've scoured probably 30, 40 websites. I didn't think to look for an online forum, like, that just didn't occur to me. I found this one site and I've got it jotted down here. Oh, it's called Menu in Progress.
Okay.
And, I went on that site and I felt like it was hugely, whereas a lot of other sites sort of dabbled in it, this one went full on. It's like, here's everything that you're going to want to know about sausage making, and it just went deep, 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 deep. And then everything you want to know about drying. Then it's like, this is the equipment you want. This is the equipment you don't want.
Sure.
This is, and I found that to be a great source. I don't know if there's any others out there, but.
Yeah, there definitely are. I'm trying to think now. There were a handful of blogs. Now they've sort of morphed into a Facebook community. And it's whatever, it's a closed community, but it's also very open.
Right.
And that's a good place to start. It's called, what's the Facebook group? Sausage Debauchery, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
That's one I've just recently discovered, and there's lots of great information on that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wonderful. Oh, yeah. I'll definitely check that out.
And those guys will link to, yeah, exactly. You're saying equipment requirements, and there'll be somebody there that's taking the time to rate them.
Right. Oh,
and do this kind of stuff. So you have a lot of information there if you're willing to sift through it.
Wow. That's amazing.
I would say if someone wanted to start doing something, there are easier things to do, right? Mm-hmm. So like if you start with a fresh sausage and you you make that something that you're not going to ferment, you're not going to dry, you're not going to do anything crazy with, and the risk is really, really very limited.
Right.
It's pretty easy to do. You can get actually, not that I'm going to, not that this is a plug for the butcher's block, but you can get casings from those guys.
That's where I buy my casings.
There you go. And so you can start that way. And a simple way to start curing things, I would, stay to whole mussels, get a piece of belly, do some reading, put it under salt, use, heaven forbid, a little bit of sodium nitrate, and you can create a pretty stable product.
I bought
pancetta really easy.
Yeah, I bought a thing. I bought a bag of prog powder, which is that. And again, wanting to make sure that I wasn't going to poison myself the first few times. I know that it's not. I don't know if it's a cop out, but I thought as entry level, I wanted to go with the safest bet.
Sure.
And so I haven't actually started using it, but yeah, I have it. I intend on.
I would say I think at the amateur level, the hobbyist should definitely consider using that and do the research on what it is. It's a really simple formula to figure out how much you can use within safe parameters.
Right.
Because the other side of safe, the other side of a non-nitrate meal is potentially a very dangerous one.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. That's great. I hadn't really thought of it before until we're all sitting here. Are you, Brian, going to be ever, because Clever Crow started as salt or did it, but Clever Crow has definitely grown.
It started as sort of, salts and, herbs and spices.
Right.
So we started off on some leased land, growing mostly spices for our spice blends, as well as, making sea salt and stuff out of our house in Courtney.
Right.
And then we started growing some salad greens and stuff, and it kind of grew from there, and we loved what we were doing. So we purchased a farm in Black Creek and expanded the salt operation and our
definitely the herbs disappointed and spice me and a little bit.
But now you're like, that's just it. You've moved on to other things. I know that you're offering more than just the salad greens. I know that like just today, Leah was saying that she's going to be at the night market selling sourdough and what have you. Like you're starting to expand your range. Is this something that Clever Crow is ever going to get into and or expand into?
I don't think that we're going to expand sort of into I'm not sure what sort of, I think it's going to be too much for our kitchen to accommodate, the dealing with the meat and the curing and stuff in the space that we have. I think we're going to keep it more to processing, the food that with our bounty that we have, making relishes and canning pears and juicing that. And when we have surplus potatoes and leeks, making soups and stuff for our freezer and stuff there. I think that in that already is enough as it is trying to run a farm, let alone.
Oh my God. I can't imagine. Because it's just the two of you. You haven't hired on any help.
We have some people that come in and mostly do some labeling and stuff, because all that stuff takes up so much time, labeling all our packaging and stuff. So,
which is beautiful. I think I said it last time you guys were on. It's still hands down my favorite packaging out of the valley ever, in any product, not just food products. I think it's brilliant packaging.
Mm. Well, thanks.
Yeah,
it's great product too. I'm looking forward to trying some of that salt in a. Not just on meals, but in some sort of curing application. I think that would be a pretty awesome future collaboration.
Yeah, right. And speaking to the retail end too, I know, actually, I shouldn't say I know. I haven't talked to you directly about it, but I know that I've talked to a few people, and they said that you're looking to move towards that, or that you're possibly going to be in the market.
That's my so my current phase. Up until this point, I've been doing... Okay, so a little bit of background. I moved here 2 years ago directly from Italy, from this thing I was doing there, which was studying cured meats. And for the last 2 years, I've been raising pigs with my uncle and been processing them myself and, you know, having them with family and giving them to friends and sort of, you know, soliciting feedback and trying to push through a few new ideas that I've had. This year, the step has been I'm going to... been doing the same thing. I've got pigs that I've been raising, and I'm going to take on a few more from Lentilis Organics down the road and process them in conjunction with Greg at the Butcher's Block to sell at the market under my own banner, which is Clandestino Meats. Down the road, I do have ambition to have a retail space and I'm in the process of getting that going, but it is because of these aforementioned sort of challenges about what it is we're doing fermenting meat.
Right.
It is a pretty tricky kind of proposition.
I can definitely see it being a little bit of a long road ahead of you.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, you also seem to have the knowledge that, you know, all the questions and concerns they have, you'll be able to answer.
Well, thanks. I hope so.
Right.
Well, I was hoping that down the road maybe there would be some collaboration between the two of you, because I know you've done some...
We've done some food workshops and stuff. And that's something like that we did a cheese workshop in the spring.
Mm-hmm. It kills me that I missed it.
Me too. I'm super sad that I missed that. It looked great.
I had just bought the book, and then I was like, wait a minute, I know that name from somewhere. Where do I know? Oh, my God. That's the book I've got. But yeah, I really do. I sincerely hope you're able to bring them back in. Or him back in. I would love to attend a future
We're certainly looking to do something like that again, and I don't know, maybe in a future collaboration, maybe Colin would like to come and we can do some stuff and do some
definitely
that'd be awesome.
A little curing workshop or
sorry to put you
workshop.
On the spot there
but well
that's right. I thought this is all about putting agreement. People on the spot
yeah. That's pretty much it yeah.
That'd be great. That's what we love doing, right?
Because I'd like to have that feeling that I'm not eating cold cuts.
Yeah.
I want to.
Yeah.
You just call it by a European name. You'll feel
better.
Charcuterie. That's hilarious.
But no, I'm just a huge meat fan. So it's always like cured meats are always something really interesting, and I very rarely do pâtés anymore. And that's partly because I work at the Atlas, which is kind of comes from a vegetarian background.
Yeah.
Brian comes from a vegetarian background.
But
you
owned the Bar None Cafe, didn't you?
Yeah, the Bar None Cafe.
Yeah, right.
So
which
we had a vegetarian restaurant.
Yeah.
So.
Right.
Well, actually, as weird as it might sound, I think of cured meats as on that spectrum, because the amount that you would need to consume, or that you should reasonably consume, is a very small amount. So when you're eating those meats, you just don't need as much. And you can use them. I think of like a lot of Italian dishes will use a little bit of pancetta to facilitate a pasta dish.
Right.
And in that sense, to me, it's almost like a gateway vegetarian food, because it's moving you towards like a complete vegetarian meal. And it's a really small amount of meat to have a satiating kind of meal.
Like an ounce or a half an ounce for an entire dish.
We'll get you covered.
Yeah.
And that speaks to the sort of frugality of the actual, what it is we're talking about, you know,
right.
A history of peasant foods and peasant cuisines, where they're salting and curing away a pig that's going to last the whole season or like
right.
the entire year. And so you're going to use it in that kind of small amount. And I personally heartily believe, just not health-wise, environmentally, otherwise, it's important to sort of carry that aspect of the tradition through as well as the celebration of eating those things.
Yeah, wow. No, I like that, because there's just, you know, that thing about eating a 20-ounce steak.
Yeah, no,
it's not me.
It's just gorging yourself, and you're
not
enjoying it. And to take the extra time to make something special and make that is something that's pretty special, I think. So,
well, that's great. Thanks for both you guys for coming in tonight. It was great talking to both of you. I feel much more empowered. I was definitely looking forward to this one more myself, for my own selfish reasons. But I definitely feel like I'm ready to get started now.
Well, good. Well, thanks for having us. And
All right.
Well, we'll definitely have to get you back, because I think this is a big subject.
Sort of feel like we've just touched on a greater scope of everything.
Sure. It's huge. I think it's huge myself.
Yeah.
Maybe selfishly, I think it's huge because I can indulge my own interests in it. But it goes deep.
Yeah.
Well, when you start talking about pâtés and confit and galantines, and then curing meat, I mean, that's one subject. Sausages is a whole another subject all on its own. So.
Sure. Yeah. And well, not to mention, not to mention things like animal welfare and the kinds of transparencies that maybe we want to see across production.
All right. So if someone wants to get a hold of you guys, the best way we'll start with Brian.
By email, clevercrowfarm@gmail.com, or on the Island Highway in Black Creek, you'll see your sign.
Cool.
Yeah, email's best for me too. You can get me at cohen@honeygrove.com, part of the Honey Grove crew. We make sourdough bread as well.
Wonderful.
Yeah. For me, it's very important.
For sure. Well, we'll definitely look forward to talking to you more about it all.
Great.
All right. And we'd like to thank our listeners for tuning in again and listening to their episode of the Edible Valley podcast. And don't forget to send us any of your comments to either you can Facebook us at the Edible Valley, or you can send us an email at ediblevalley@gmail.com. We're definitely on Twitter at Edible Valley, and there's a lot of Edible Valley that you can get a hold of us at. So,
pretty much. Yeah, and thanks to our sponsors, of course, that make this happen, The Butcher's Block and Atlas Cafe and Ivan's Truffles. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Great, thanks.
All right.
The Atlas Cafe, celebrating 20 years in the Comox Valley. Globally inspired, locally sourced.
Do you like chocolate?
I like chocolate.
IvansTruffles.com.